marital couples,
but also with veteran marriages. I've now taken a few hundred couples through 5 weeks of customized marital work. When I do that, we have an exercise that we do nearly every time. It's one whole session on assertive communication. The problem is, a lot of us from this region of the country tend to think that assertive is the same thing as aggressive, when they're not the same things at all. Assertive behavior, assertive communication is that healthy, honest, middle ground between aggressive and passive-aggressive behaviors. Surely we Southerners can diagnose what's happening here in Luke chapter 10 then. Because nowhere more so than, especially the deep south where I'm from, is the culture bent toward passive-aggressive behavior in its ways of dealing with each other. We love to tell someone something, but do so in a way that lets us slip away before it really dawns on them what we've said to them. The question that's not really a question after all, but a statement instead. The hug that's ceremonial but not sincere. The gift that's just a smokescreen for the ill will we harbor inside. Or the compliment that's actually backhanded and insulting. Southerners, not all of us, and surely not you. Southerners often do this sort of thing. One acquaintance described a congregation in Atlanta that he had pastored by saying, "I have never served a place where more folks would come in with a cake in one hand, but in reality they were hiding a knife behind their back." Lately, you've heard me a time or two caution us to not always jump to the automatic conclusion that if a scribe, or perhaps in this case a Pharisee, who questioned Jesus did so, was automatically up to no good. You've heard me caution us to all remember that. To not assume that they had ill will in their hearts every time they spoke up, because in the church system, in that place and time, they had a job to do. Well, this time, in Luke's narration of the story, he makes us suspect that nothing good was going on here at all. The story begins this way. Just then a lawyer stood up to test Jesus. You heard that just a minute ago. "Teacher," he said, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus responded to him, as he so often did to these tests, with a question of his own. "What is written in the law?" Jesus asked him. "What have you read there?" I love how Jesus could turn the tables on his tormentors so quickly. Seeing a teachable moment here, Jesus made the inquisitor answer his own question. The man answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself." And what the lawyer used here is actually, as you know, the old Hebrew Shema from Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 5. And then he tacked on part of a verse from Leviticus 19 and put them all together so that they sounded like one verse he was quoting from the Old Testament. And when the lawyer answered correctly, using the two commands in one bias that Jesus loved, he responded by saying, "Good answer, good answer. Do this and you will live." But wanting to justify himself, he asked Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Now, Richard Vinson believes that this question in verse 29 is actually the second passive-aggressive behavior, the second passive-aggressive act by one asking questions, because what he's truly asking here of Jesus is for him to tell him the boundaries of neighborliness. He supposes he knows his own neighbors well enough. He wants Jesus to tell him who is not his neighbor. Or as Fred Craddock once put it, his question about who was his neighbor is the man's way of saying, "Jesus, you are not going to get off the hook that easy. Let's see you define neighbor according to the law." Well, this is the backdrop in front of which Jesus began to teach with one of the most beloved stories he ever told. People have called this parable a variety of names. The parable of the Good Samaritan is the most common way we all think of the story that Jesus told. Some have focused on the larger point and called it the parable of the loving neighbor. Still others have referred to this as the parable of the neglectful neighbors. There are yet other titles people have used as they study this. A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell into the hands of robbers who stripped him and beat him and went away, leaving him half dead. We looked at this parable one time about a year ago, right after I first got here, and I told you that I'd be back to take a closer look at this one day, and that day has come. I want to make sure that we turn it and look at it from several sides of this parable to try to get all the riches. Well, we'll never get all the riches. Try to get more of the riches that are waiting for us there. We'd all do well to remember something pretty important, because I'm probably going to refer to it interchangeably as a story and as a parable, but it is just that. It's a parable. Jesus told it. He made it up for teaching purposes. It is not a real story. There are figures in the Bible mentioned in other accounts that we can learn more about by looking backwards or looking forward. We find them popping up elsewhere in the Bible, so we fill in some of the blanks. History sometimes has other documents that tell us about people who are named in the Bible. Not so with Jesus' parables. But then again, don't you guess all of his parables contained more than a grain of truth and true detail, and that there were amalgams of people that he knew around him? So it is that as we hear this one unfold, and we picture the person who is lying beside the road, beaten and nearly dead, left for dead, it's uncomfortable for me to admit, for obvious reasons, that the story has a couple of villains that we focus on for all the right reasons. There was first a priest and then a Levite who passed up the beaten man who left the robbed person on the side of the road. And we aren't given by the parable any motive for these two failing to stop. Just like the robbers, we aren't supposed to know in the story more about the priest and the Levite, because they aren't the ultimate point. We could suppose that these two occupy equal places in the story, but they don't. Levites, like priests, descended from the same tribe. But priests had to come not only from the Levite tribe, but also from Aaron's line specifically. Levites not from Aaron's line were ineligible to serve, although some of them might have assisted. Now, the cardinal sin, and I'm self-aware of this, the cardinal sin of any minister may be to be in a hurry. It's just simply not allowed. I enter the building here at around 8 o'clock, no later than 8 o'clock on Sundays. I make final setups in my own Sunday school classroom because I'll be teaching there soon. I get to greet and visit with the worshipers, and by 8:45, we've started the early worship service. I preach for 20 minutes there, and then I get another few minutes after that to visit, but then it's off through the hallways to my Sunday school classroom. I do what I want all of our teachers doing. I get there early. I try to be one of the first people to arrive. I try to greet the people who are coming there. That's where we get to know more about each other, in that small group community that we share. I teach for roughly 40 minutes during that hour, and then it's off through the hallways again with 15 minutes to put on a microphone, a jacket, check in with the sound folks, pray with the deacons, pray with the choir as they're leading, and into the next service we go, and heaven forbid I stopped by the bathroom. So on and so forth. Next thing I know, it's 12:20, and I've just walked into whatever's left of the coffee fellowship after church. And I bet someone says, he never has time to talk with me. It's always hurry here and hurry there. These priests and Levites just had no time for the Samaritan. We don't know why. And we really do more in the parable than Luke probably wants us to. We assume that all Jews hated all Samaritans, and they didn't. We assume that Samaritans and Jews had nothing to do with each other, when actually some of them did business back and forth with each other, it seems, interacted a bit. We assumed that all priests were wealthy and well provided for, when in fact not all priests were, especially those from rural areas. They were not well provided for, and they certainly weren't all snobs. We assumed that the priests were worried about ritual purity and therefore might not have wanted to have touched a dead body or an injured body, and that is not the case either. In any event, we are dissatisfied that they didn't stop, and we should be. We are supposed to be bothered that they didn't. Of course, I haven't taken a good full look at this story until I also wonder what it was like to be the victim, the robbed man, left there half dead and with no clothes, injured and humiliated, victimized, and not one person to stop. Have you ever felt like your life had ground to a stop and everyone in the whole world was just rushing by at breakneck speed without notice? If you've ever lost a loved one, then you know that feeling. People love on you and send you cards and casseroles, but as soon as they walk away from the graveside with you, you are still in your profound grief. A lot of times just getting started in some ways, and everyone else has just gone right back to their routines. Reba McEntire wrote an entire song called "The World Ain't Gonna Stop for My Broken Heart." It was about the time that in a plane crash she lost her entire band. She didn't do anything musically for an entire year, and when she did surface, this song was the first thing that she recorded. "The world ain't gonna stop for my broken heart." You know, it's nothing against you. The people who went to the graveside with you have their own families. They have their own homes. They have jobs and commitments. Even the priests and Levites, we get called to the next hospital and the next hospice bedside. We get called back to the sermon that must be written that week and every week just like it, and the Bible study that had better be ready and good for Wednesday night. You walk through the valley of the shadow of death. You lose your job. You have the death of a dream, an ideal. And you're left by life beaten up and robbed off on the side of the road and in the ditch, and no one seems to notice and stop with you. Well, we still haven't looked completely at this story until we consider one other role in this parable at least. I can wonder what it would be like to be the victim. I can be inspired by the heroes. I can wonder why the priest and the Levite didn't stop. We don't want to be like them. But until I can admit that I also could have been the one who put this man in the ditch in the first place, the one who beat him and robbed him at the very least of his dignity, until I consider that, I haven't taken a complete look at this parable. Have you ever considered the power that you have to hurt people around you? Oh, we want to get you to focus on the positive, so we usually try to challenge you to do good things, to be a good person. But have you ever confronted your own ability, maybe your tendency sometimes, depending on your personality, to inflict life-robbing good on others around you? You see, it's not the priest and the Levite who bother me here as much as it is the ones we know the least about. How do I hurt others around me? How often do I miss chances to instead give life when taking from others is often the easier option? But we move on because time is ticking and because we want to take a good look still at this story. Because you see, we so rightly look in this and we focus on the one who did stop with this man. He has a lot to teach us. He makes us want to be better people. I don't know about you, but I am drawn to the folks around me who make me want to be a better person. The generosity of the compassionate act in this parable of tending to this victim catches our eye. We imagine this Samaritan handling the beaten man with gentleness and care. He bandaged the wounds himself and saw that the person got immediate care and that all the care that he needed, and he didn't have to do any of this. You know, in the recent fire downtown, all of us had a chance to be reminded freshly that there are heroes living among us, and they're around us every day. I looked over from my desk that afternoon, just after 2:30, and noticed there was a plume of smoke. Fact is, you could see orange licks of fire jumping above the tallest rooftops between me and the building that burned on Main Street. And fire trucks and first responders, law enforcement, they were beginning to arrive and get in position as I walked down there to see what was going on. I just walked down our street and stood with the folks from the Chamber of Commerce. Bill Peek was down there. Later, some other of our members were there at the same place. It was a terrible-looking fire, obviously a big one that was getting out of control fast. The smoke was already drifting horribly, and as they kept moving us further away, I saw two things. First of all, I saw our own church member, Bill Peek, whose office was right there by where we were waiting. He went in and grabbed flats of water and took them. He disappeared into the smoke and took them to the firemen who were arriving so that they would have that nearby as they worked. But then they pushed us all further back down the street. And as they pushed us further away to watch the fire, the firemen were running into the smoke. They were running into the flame. They were going the opposite direction. What they were doing goes against every natural impulse that is born into us. What they do is heroic, and they battled for a solid 4 hours, this fire, until they had it put out, and then they had to come back that night and put it out again. And they kept it from damaging more of downtown than it might have. It's just not natural what they and our law enforcement officers do sometimes. Well, it's not natural always what the Good Samaritan did in our parable either. We marvel at how this good neighbor took the stranger, a Samaritan no less, this person who did all this good, and put this man up at his own expense, paid for the extended medical care, told the innkeeper that if the stranger's care ended up costing more, he'd be back in a couple of days and he would settle the bill. We are inspired by this one because we should be. But finally, there's one other hero right beneath our noses in this story. One last good person that we need to make sure that we look at, because it is represented, we don't get an outcome, but it's represented in the parable, that the innkeeper did what was asked of him and took the man in. And it's inferred that the story went on from there. And that amazes me. And I bet it does you too. You see, there's a lot here that teaches us. There are people in our lives, if we're watching, who inspire us and make us want to be generous. There are giving people who just, it seems, cannot be outgiven. They make us want to be good to someone that we don't have to be good to. They make us want to be better people. Now, let me acknowledge that someone who's within the sound of my voice has a saying going through their head about right now. They're saying, no good deed goes unpunished. That's often our reaction to these kinds of moments in life. You know, on balance, maybe not in a particular moment, but on balance in the larger picture of life, I just don't think that turns out to be true. Reading the story, this parable that Jesus told more completely, confronts me. It challenges and convicts me in the very best ways. Even better, reading the parable more completely also inspires me to see both what I don't want to be, but also what I hope to be. These are transforming words. And when we let them come to life, our lives are richer. They are stories that teach and shape us. They give us cause to hope. They also give us a call to help. Speaking of, we move now into a time of commissioning. We have youth and adults alike who have already, in some cases, begun to serve right among us and will eventually travel to serve and to learn. And so in our bulletin, we move into our time of commissioning. While Steve is coming to lead us, let me invite all those, don't be bashful, this is your time to move. If you are going to passport camp, if you are serving in music camp or VBS, if you have served or are going to serve today in the Ram Medical Ministries over in Emporia, if you are going to help us to host First Baptist Church Goldsboro's youth group, which arrives tonight to work in our community with Cooperative Ministries, if you are serving missionally by way of working on or have already been here to work on the chemotherapy kits that have begun, come on down front if you will. And come stand here. It's risky to call on folks, so this is not your time to be bashful or modest. This is your time to be here right at where my hand is pointing. Come on down and accept my invitation, and let's participate in this commissioning service together.
And please.